held. "Little brother, I'm beginning to think that you didn't come here today because of my beautiful sandwiches or because you love me." Henry's eyes rolled to the ceiling, but then quickly rested on the buffalo. I had seen that look before. It wasn't a look you could stand for long. It burned. It burned because he cared. I watched the buffalo to see what kind of effect it had on him, but the only thing that happened was that I heard drums, far in the distance. I'm sure they were just in my head, but as I thought this, I could see the buffalo's head nod ever so slightly, keeping time with my drums. His eyes stayed locked with Henry's, and I'm sure he heard them too. When we got outside, one of the tires was flat, so I loaned Henry a quarter and we pumped it back up. He said it would hold, and I cursed the day the truck was built. As we pulled out of the parking lot, I noticed that the Cherokee was gone. We couldn't afford tricked-out Jeeps with the measly budget we had. I had a truck that was 2 years old, but the rest of the force either had 5-year-old vehicles or, like Jim Ferguson, drove their own and got reimbursed for mileage. I had meant to call into the office while at the Buffalo's place, but it had slipped my mind. Some way to run a murder investigation. The little bird case had gone to the jury at 2:50 on the afternoon of September 16th, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. I'm pretty sure I was the only one in the county who noticed it on the calendar that hung on the bulletin board behind the witness stand. The trial and all its paraphernalia seemed to take on the lessening expectations of some television movie of the week. I had to remind myself that it was real. The jury was charged with reaching a decision on 9 counts, 1 charge of conspiracy, 4 counts of aggravated assault involving the use of the broom and bat and the act of oral sex, and 4 counts of sexual contact in which the defendants were charged with fondling Melissa's breasts and forcing her to masturbate them. They were also given a list of 15 lesser charges. I remembered Vern Selby leaning over his desk and clasping his hands into a joined fist. He instructed the jury to ponder 2 main questions. Was force or coercion used against Melissa Littlebird? And was the Cheyenne girl mentally defective? And, as an auxiliary, did Cody, George, Jacob, and Brian know that? Or should they have known that? The judge had explained that coercion was not simply the use of brute force, but that it could be a subtler process, that the jury would have to decide if Melissa had been conned into going into the basement, whether she had been vulnerable because of her psychological condition, whether the size and configuration of the basement intimidated her, or whether the number of boys and what they had told her before she left had pressured her into submitting. Vern didn't look up when he changed gears. He just kept looking at his collective fist and talking like one of those auctioneers at an auction where nobody's buying anything. He told them that the legal term mentally defective did not mean that someone was slow or retarded. It meant that a person did not understand that she had a right to refuse sex or was incapable of refusing, and that to convict on this charge, the jury would have to agree that the defendants knew or should have known that Melissa Littlebird was defective. Lucian and I had had a long conversation about it after the trial. He said you had to do what you could do, and you did it the best you could, that if things turned or didn't turn out the way you wanted, you let it go. If you did anything else, you were opening yourself up to very bad things. I hadn't let it go. So was that where I was now? In the land of very bad things? Was I there alone, or was Melissa there with me, dragging our red rowboat across the teepee rings of the high plains? And who else was there with us, under those black and blue skies, carrying a very large caliber buffalo rifle? "What are you thinking about, badass?" I didn't respond, just sat there looking out the windshield at things to come. "You know, I think I will start calling that the little bird look. I stared at the decrepit chrome antenna, shivering in the velocity of roughly 45 miles an hour. Captain America was hanging in there. Yea, verily, though I walked through the valley of very bad things. I was going to have to bring Turk back up from Powder Junction, and there was a dark little part of my soul that was looking forward to it. I told that dark little part to shut up and go curl up in a corner, and it did, but not completely. It never did, not completely. It is the one where the eyes bug out a little and those two little lines dig into the corners of your mouth. He turned back to the road. It is very manly. I continued to look through the glass and attempted to unbug my eyes. I wish I had a look like that. I needed a change of subject. You still have your horses? A little breath of air came out as he responded.
My uncle's horses, yes.
Henry never claimed the horses, even though they had been his for more than 10 years. It was because they were Appaloosas. He felt about Appaloosas the way I felt about his truck. They were here just to piss him off. Henry figured that the reason the Cheyenne had always ridden Appaloosas into battle was because by the time the men got there, they were so angry with the horses, they were ready to kill everything. We should go out and ride sometime. He turned to look at me again. His eyes bugged a little this time.
You hate horses.
I didn't hate horses. I just didn't like them. I didn't really want to go riding. I was just hoping the shock value of the statement would change the subject. The Founding Fathers used to say that riding was good for the digestion.
Whose Founding Fathers?
Mine. Your guys didn't even have horses until you stole them from the Spanish. We headed over to the mission? He smiled and nodded.
Yes.
Like most of the houses on the reservation, the St. Lebre Mission had a basketball court out back. It was a rough-looking place, with large chunks of the asphalt crumbling off at the edges in pieces as big as softballs. What little paint there had been to signify the out-of-bounds, foul, and three-point areas had long since faded into the dark gray of the asphalt's aggregate. It had a steel backboard painted to depict a war shield in faded and chipped reds, blacks, yellows, and whites. There was a hoop with no net, and despite the cold, there were four young men playing a game of pickup in their shirt sleeves. One of the T-shirts read, "My heroes have always killed cowboys," and another read, "Fightin' Whiteys in 50s script." The boys were classic Cheyenne, tall and lean, with a touch of casualness that betrayed their age. I wondered why they were here, not in school, but I figured I had enough on my plate without being a truant officer. He cut the motor and started to get out.
Do me a favor and stay in the truck.
I looked back at him, concern in my eyes. Even if they don't hit the open man on the give and go? He closed the door and I watched him saunter toward the court. The word insouciance was invented for Henry, and against it the teenage version suffered. The bear was doing vintage James Dean, and it made the boys look like a bunch of basketball-playing Pat Boones. I wondered if they knew Henry. Everybody out here was related in a complex order of extended family. I wondered how many the bear helped. I had been with him when he made the numerous deposits into the various accounts. $100 here and $100 there. I also knew that all the groceries he bought in town didn't end up at the bar. All of these actions made up an intricate network that provided for the individual without exacting the cost of self-respect. Henry stopped at the edge of the pavement and leaned against the opening in the sagging chain-link fence, his thumbs hooked in his jeans. They looked at him, sneaking glances, figuring that whatever he wanted was his problem. It would be interesting to see how quickly he could make his problem theirs. It didn't take long. After a fadeaway from the far corner, the ball deflected off the hoop and bounced right over to him. He didn't move, just lodged the ball to a stop with his boot. They fanned out as they came, like coyotes approaching their first wolf. One of them, The tallest one said something, and Henry nodded by throwing his head back a bit and inviting them closer. The tall one started to stoop for the ball but pulled up short. The bear must have said something. Nobody moved. Then I saw the back of Henry's head shift slightly, and the teenagers started laughing. All of them, except the tall one. He cocked his head to one side and said something back, and I would bet it wasn't pleasant. A brief moment passed, and Henry bent over and came up with the ball, spinning it in both hands. From the movement of his head, I could tell he was talking trash. The tall kid nodded, turned, and started walking back toward the court as Henry took one step after him, lined up, and shot. It wasn't anything all that miraculous, about a 25-foot jumper that bounced off the rim twice and fell through, but for a guy who hadn't held one of the things in 10 years, it wasn't bad. The tall kid turned and looked at him. Henry spread his hands out in an apologetic gesture and walked over to the young man. Throwing a paw around his shoulders, he steered him back over to the group. They were all talking and laughing now, with a few gestures from the boys indicating the road behind the Missions Indian School and beyond. They tossed Henry the ball again as he turned and started back for the truck. I saw him stop, look at the much greater distance to the basket, then shrug and throw the ball back to the tall one. It would have been showing off. The boys helped push start the res dog, and we got going again. You know, I remember a time when you would have made that shot, nothing but net. Artie Small Song's mother lived up a dirt road off 566 going toward Custer National Forest. It looked like a cliff dwelling with the parted-out vehicles and abandoned lesser trailer homes wedged into the rock walls of the little canyon. It was a grand location, if a little cluttered, and the farther you went back into the place, the older the vehicles got. By the time we climbed our way to the trailer that had a little stovepipe with a trail of smoke coming out, I was looking for the original wheel. I asked him to park the truck headed down the hill, which he did after a little grumbling. Once again, I waited and wondered why it was I was even here. I rolled down the window as far as it would go, about halfway, and breathed. The sharp contrast of the canyon air mingled with the musty warmth of the truck. There was one thing I liked about Henry's truck, even if I never told him. Its comfortable smell of old steel, earth, and leather. I had grown up in old trucks like these, and there was a security there, a sense memory that transcended brand names and badge loyalties. I looked around at the assembled vehicular dreams and thought about the mobility of Western longings. None of the wheels around me would likely ever roll again. But were there any deep-seated passions still harbored in the sun-dried interiors and slowly rusting bodies? It was doubtful, but hope does tend to roll eternal. He was on the makeshift porch, talking to an older woman through a closed screen door. His hands hung loose to his sides. After a while, the inside door closed and he returned. He grinded the starter a few times, then quietly turned the wheel and coasted down the hill. Hopes dashed. Well, once the truck lurched to a start, he mumbled, "A different girlfriend." We followed 566 to 39, took a right and headed north. Would the gun be there or with his mother? The response was a little ominous. Artie always keeps his guns with him. Artie Small Song's latest hit didn't live too far from the cutoff that headed back to Lame Deer. Alice Shoulderblade was a dental hygiene student at the college in Sheridan, but spent her weekends back on the res with Artie. Henry said that chances were she wasn't there, it being a Wednesday, but you never knew when Artie might pop up. It was a smallish white house with wooden clapboard sides and a bare dirt yard that had a number of dogs asleep alongside the foundation and under the porch. When we drove up, They roiled out at us from all directions and made a great show of attacking the truck and raising a General Kane. There was one Blue Heeler Border Collie mix. The rest were anybody's guess. Henry rolled down his own window as he parked and growled very loudly, "Wahumpy!" The dog slid to a stop, yelped, and ran back under the porch, so far back I couldn't see them. As he opened his door, he paused and looked at me. "Lakota for Stew. Those dogs are Sioux from Pine Ridge." "How can you tell?" Henry knocked. "Cheyenne dogs would wait quietly till you got out of the truck." Nobody answered, so he knocked again. This time, the force of his knocking jarred the door open about 2 inches, and we looked at each other. "On the reservation, this constitutes an invitation." I thought about the numerous laws, both federal and local, that I was breaking as I crept in after him. There wasn't a whole lot there, only a few pieces of furniture, and a framed picture of Alice at what I'm sure was her senior prom. There were lots of boxes scattered around the living room, filled with hunting clothes, old lace-up boots, videotapes, and reloading equipment. It was difficult to discern whether Artie was moving in or out. "Maybe Alice doesn't live here anymore." This to the roll of the eyes and a turn of the back as he checked the small kitchen. I kneeled by the box containing the reloading equipment and took a look at the dies. The ones that were in the machine read 223. Henry came back through and wandered farther down a short hallway, checking each room as he went. I carefully rummaged through the loading box and came up with a small wooden container of dies in separate cardboard. The third one I pulled out was old and didn't have any markings. Automatically, I reached to the pancake holster at the small of my back. By the time I had popped the safety strap and pulled the .45 out, Henry had returned from the hallway. When he saw the gun, he stopped and quickly looked around the little house, finally returning his look to me. "What?"
"What?"
"The gun."
Checking the caliber on his dies.
He stretched his shoulder muscles.
"Jesus, you scared the shit out of me."
I smiled and unlocked the safety, pressing the side of my thumb against the button, allowing the magazine to slide into my other hand. I rested the die on the closed wooden box and thumbed a shell from the Colt, setting the bullet next to the die. The circumference was identical. Artie Smallsong could reload Sharp's .45 semis.
"Okay, if I were a gun in this house, where would I be?"
We both said it at the same time.
"Closet."
I carefully repacked the dies, placing everything back in the box as it had been. Then I popped the bullet back in the magazine, reloaded my weapon, and replaced it in the holster. I followed Henry down the hallway to the only bedroom at the end, turned the corner, and saw him standing with his hands on his hips.
"You better come look at this."
I walked over to the open door of the closet and looked in. There were enough weapons in there to arm a small platoon. There were FAL-308s, AK-47s, MAC-10s, and the M-16s leaned against the inside wall. There was even an Armalite M-50 and a collection of Mossberg 12-gauge short barrel and tactical shotguns. Even sitting on the wooden cases of ammunition in a dental hygienist's closet, they looked deadly. Some of the guns were civilian versions, but others were fully automatic and fully functional. I leaned against the door jamb and crossed my arms.
"Wow." "Yes."
He looked sad.
"I am guessing Artie does not have a federal license for all this automatic stuff."
"Maybe he's going to open a store?"
"Yes, Guns R Us."
He leaned in for a closer look.
"Is that an M50?
"Looks like to me." I poked my head in and looked in the other corners. "I bet if we dig in those crates down there, we'll find ourselves a couple of 45 ACPs that match the dies in the other room." I looked around. "Maybe this is a conversation we should have in the truck." He followed me out after closing the closet door, and I felt a lot better when we were standing on the porch.
I think I heard a few low growls as we walked off the steps, but the mad rush for our heels didn't come. We leaned against the front of the truck's grill guard and talked. It had turned out to be a beautiful day, and the temperature was rapidly approaching 45. I unbuttoned my jacket and put an arm up. "Well, I'll tell you what I didn't see in there." "Yes, Artie's taste in weapons seems to run au courant." I turned to look at him. "I'm pleased to see that some of that high school French took." He continued to look at the house. "Oui." "What do you know about Artie, other than his mama don't love him no more?" I waited while he composed himself. I don't know if not knowing Artie was a full-fledged militiaist or if weighing the odds on his being guilty of murdering Cody Pritchard embarrassed him, but his jaw set and the eyes hardened. "Artie is an angry young man." He paused. "What do you know about him?" I had looked Artie up and came clean. "He's got 2 cases of aggravated assault, 1 pending. He did a domestic for spousal abuse over in South Dakota and has 2 unpaid speeding tickets here in Wyoming." I waited a moment. "You seem to be taking this personally." He shook his head. "I am reacting to the lost potential." "Yep. I know you wouldn't know anything about that angry young man stuff." We both shook our heads. "No." I had to push the truck this time twice. The first time it jumped when he let out the clutch and barked all the skin off my right shin. The second time, with my arm locked straight with the effort of moving the 2-ton beast, it stoved my shoulder and blew a sooty cloud of smoke and unburnt gas in my face. I climbed in and shut the door. "I hate this truck." We drove back toward Lame Deer on 39, and I peeled off my jacket and laid it on the seat between us. I thought about where we were headed, about Lonnie. I wondered how long it would take for the little bird, Look, to come back. Jim Ferguson wore a gun at the trial. That alone was enough to make me laugh, but the context robbed me of my sense of humor. It was before Vic, so my 2 deputies were Lenny Roll and Jim. Jim kept fussing with his belt, and Lenny was trying to catch a nap as he leaned against the bookcases of burgundy, leather-covered Shepherd's Wyoming citations. I told Jim to get his belt adjusted because fidgeting deputies with guns made the common populace nervous, and excused myself to go to the bathroom. When I got there, Lonnie Littlebird was trying to get his wheelchair into one of the stalls. The county hadn't gotten around to putting in handicapped facilities, and Lonnie wasn't fitting. He looked up through his Coke bottle glasses and smiled. Yes, I'm having troubles. It is so." I looked around. I hadn't noticed anybody on the way in. "Lonnie, is there anybody to help you?" He continued to smile. "You." He was a small man, even counting the 2 missing legs, and it was relatively easy to lift him up and hold him as he unbuttoned his pants. I sat him on the toilet. The grin never left his face. He had a large head with prominent ears. The nose was flat and looked like it had been broken numerous times. There was a rumor that the old guy had played professional baseball for one of the teams in the Midwest, but as far as I knew, it was only a rumor. He spoke as I started to close the stall door. Sheriff? I paused. "Yep, Lonnie." "You know how old I am, Sheriff?" I figured about 65. "No, Lonnie, I can't say that I do."
53 years old."
"Yes, it is so." "Jesus. Lonnie, that's pretty young." There was silence for a while, and I was afraid I had said something wrong. "Lonnie?"
"Sometimes I think it's very old."
Another pause, and I zipped up and moved over to the sink to wash my hands.
Sometimes I feel like I've been here a very long time.
I pulled out a paper towel and dried my hands. Yep, I feel like that sometimes too, Lonnie.
These boys, the ones that have done this thing to my daughter.
My breath caught in my throat.
It's a bad thing they've done, yes?
I leaned against the counter and looked at the stall door. Yes, it is a bad thing that they have done. There was a long silence, and I was glad no one could see my eyes well in anger and frustration. Very bad. The voice that came back was soft.
I get confused sometimes. And I just wanted to ask you.
When I got back to the courtroom, the jury light was glowing red. There was a small dish attached to Lonnie's house that brought in the world, and I'm pretty sure who had ordered and paid for it. Henry's eyes were beginning to glaze over as Lonnie gave us his version of what was happening in this particular daytime drama, but I did my best to pay attention.
The problem started at the health clinic. That's where Dirk begged Catalina to not go through with the abortion. Cat agreed and said she was looking forward to having a family. But I'm not so sure. After they left the clinic, there were complications, but the doctors said she would be all right. So Dirk dropped her off at the mansion and went over to see Letitia. But when he got there, Letitia told him that he needed to be with Catalina now that she's pregnant. So he left, but that's okay, 'cause now Letitia is with Ben, and he seems to be a good fella. Yes, it is so.
Lonnie watched soap operas, because there was no baseball in November. The rumors of Lonnie's playing pro ball turned out to be true. There was baseball paraphernalia scattered in a few spots around the place, baseball bats tucked into corners, old gloves stacked up on shelves. There were pictures of Lonnie standing around with Cubs, Billy Williams and Ferguson Jenkins, Cardinals, Lou Brock and Joe Torre, Reds, Tony Perez and Johnny Bench, whom he blamed for ending his career.
After I saw him coming up, I just didn't see any reason to go on playing. He's part Indian, too, you know, Choctaw.
Yes, it is so. The only thing that outnumbered the baseball pictures were photographs of Melissa. The only photographs I had of Melissa were not good ones. I stopped before an especially wonderful one of her in full dancing regalia, seated on a palomino in front of a painted teepee. Its frame had started out as gold, but was now rusted and tarnished at the edges. It was likely it was taken down and handled a great deal. I thought about defects, about the rape, the trial, and the Little Bighorn reenactment where I had seen her last. Lonnie probably thought about those things a lot, too. It was nearing 1 o'clock, and Lonnie had wheeled himself into the kitchen to instruct Henry how to make the pickle loaf, yellow American sliced cheese and Kraft spread sandwiches on Wonder Bread that would be our lunch. This was my kind of food, but Henry's gourmet sensibilities were having a hard time of it.
"Lonnie, I buy you good food. Why don't you eat it?"
"Your good food is complicated and takes too long to make. There are Vlasic pickle stackers in the door there."
With a sigh, Henry returned to the refrigerator, retrieved the jar of sliced pickles, and got ice from the freezer side of the appliance.
"Lonnie, are you buying all that frozen food off the Schwann's truck again?"
He looked over at me through those thick metal-framed glasses, needing an ally. And if Lonnie had said that little green men had deposited the 8 boxes of Hot Pockets in his freezer, I was going to agree.
"I feel sorry for him when he drives all the way up the driveway."
I nodded as he continued.
"We have good talks. He is from Kentucky."
I nodded some more. It was a little single-level ranch house that must have been built in the 50s. And the only things that kept me from thinking I was on one of those family sitcoms from the period was the amount of Indian art and craft that decorated it and the concrete ramps that led up to the doors of the spotless house. Lonnie Littlebird was on a campaign to get his daughter back from that gaggle of ants in closer to town. This campaign meant Lonnie didn't drink, Lonnie didn't smoke, and Lonnie didn't use the Lord's name in vain, at least when any of the ants were in earshot. There was Bark's root beer in the refrigerator beside the pickled pig's feet, and that's what we were drinking. I finish off the end of my two sandwiches. When did Artie sell that rifle, Lonnie? About a year ago. He sold that gun to that Buffalo Bill Museum over in Cody. Yes, it was winter, and he needed the money. He took a swig of his root beer and studied the formica for a moment. Not everybody has a nice house like mine. His eyes glanced furtively at Henry. I got the feeling Lonnie liked secrets. A moment passed.
Sheriff?
Yep, Lonnie. Do you think that Artie did this thing to this boy? I picked up the root beer can and looked at it. As near as I could figure, it had been about 20 years since I had tasted the stuff. Well, I'm just checking everything out. Everything and everybody. He smiled.
Am I being checked out also?
I looked at the little spark behind the glasses and wasn't going to be the one to tell him that without any legs, he was kind of low on our list of suspects. Just following up on all the leads, Lonnie. He continued to smile, but looked over to Henry and said a few short words in Cheyenne. Henry glanced at me, then back to his cousin, and then got up and walked out, turning the corner of the hallway. My eyes returned to Lonnie with a question, but he only sat there, looking back through glasses so thick you could see little rainbows at the edges. After a moment or two, I heard Henry returning down the hallway, his boots padding softly on the wall-to-wall carpeting. When he turned the corner again, he was carrying an old leather rifle scabbard with the straps you attached to a saddle hanging down, unbuckled. Due to my recent course of study, I recognized the sharp's butt plate that stuck out the end. When he got to the counter, he handed the weapon to me. I looked up at Lonnie, who gestured for me to take out the buffalo gun. I carefully slid the rifle from its wool-lined sheath and rested the butt on my knee, and it was the most beautiful gun I had ever seen. It wasn't in as good shape as Omar's. There were scratches along the stock and the part of the foregrip that was wood, but each scar had been lovingly poulticed with oil and polished to a gleaming sheen. The metal had not been so lucky. Someone had taken steel wool to it at some point, and the ruddy sepia tone of its original color only showed in small creases. The rest was ghostly silver. There was a simple cross of brass tacks in the stock. The pattern, a great deal like the one on the side of Red Road Contracting's truck, and 10 distinct notches along the top ridge of the stock. The foregrip had 3 red wool trading cloth wraps ornamented with quillwork and with smaller feathers than I had seen on the scabbard of Omar's gun, or lately in plastic bags. I touched the feathers and looked at Henry. Owl. Messenger from the world of the dead, indeed. I turned the rifle around and looked at the magnificent pattern beaded underneath. Lonnie looked at me through the magnifying glasses.
The pattern is called Dead Man's Body.
Yes, it is so. Chapter 8. On the afternoon of June 25th, 1876, as the heat waves rolled from the buffalo grass, giving the impression of a breeze that did not exist, Colonel George Armstrong Custer and 5 companies of the 7th Cavalry rode into the valley of the Little Bighorn. Also that afternoon, Davy Force, a pitcher for the Philadelphia Athletics, went 6-for-6 against Chicago, who scored 4 runs in the 9th to pull out a 14-13 victory. Custer was not so lucky. The report of the Secretary of War states that the 5 companies had 405 Springfield carbines, caliber 45, along with their single-action 396 Colt revolvers, caliber 45. What the 7th Cavalry contingency did not carry were any sharps. When the fight began, only about half the Indians had guns. And they were a varied sort, muzzleloaders, Spencer carbines, old-fashioned Henry rifles, and an unspecified number of sharps. The army didn't stand much of a chance, trapped on that beautiful hillside with no reinforcements coming. I thought about how those gentle slopes smelled and sounded on a glorious summer day, about how they might have smelled and sounded that June day in 1876. I also thought about the pumpkin that had exploded from a very long distance in Omar's back pasture. When Little Wolf led a straggling band of 33 Northern Cheyenne warriors into surrender 2.5 years later on March 25, 1879, they handed in 20 assorted rifles and carbines, of which the majority were sharps, numbering 9. I held in my hands the 10th. So, your great-great-grandfather didn't surrender his. He continued to look out the windshield as he drove. I guess he did not completely trust the white man. Go figure. I looked down at the rifle, the butt resting on the toe of my boot. I didn't want the truck to touch it. Do these 10 little notches along the ridge here mean what I think they mean? Another potato digger bites the dust. He slowed as a mule deer darted across the road a couple of 100 yards ahead, and, sure as anything, another followed. No, it stands for the 10th Rifle. It was so they could tell them apart. He saw me looking at all the beads, feathers, and silver tacks. All that was put on later. The Cheyenne got their weapons by trading or capture. I didn't ask how they got this lot of 10. Okay, so your great-great-grandfather surrenders in 1879 but hides this old boy out on the range, wrapped up in 2 inches of bear grease. When did they get out? As near as I can tell, we never have. I raised an eyebrow. When did the soldiers let him go? About 6 months later, winter was coming on, and they did not want to have to feed them. He went back and got it 6 months later? Yes. He smiled to himself. We were tough in the day. I looked at the gun again. Any idea when it was last shot? The smile played out thinly on his lips. Friday of last week. Very funny. How come your cousin has it? It is in the family. That is all that matters. No one in the family has personal ownership. But I doubt anybody would argue if I claimed it. I thought of the T-Bird. Like Lola? Like Lola. He smiled to himself some more. Anyway, it is haunted. As it grew darker, the soft Wyoming sky drifted into night. I pulled out my watch to see what time it was, 5:30. I still had time to go home and take a shower and get the truck off of me. I was looking forward to being with Vonnie, with somebody who didn't have any connection with the case. When we picked up the wine at the Pony, he left the truck running. Dina Minicamps came out to talk with me while Henry rummaged through the wine coolers. She tended bar for Henry when he wasn't there, was one of Henry's protégés in billiards, and was a good friend of Katie's, although she was about 4 years older. You would be hard-pressed to find a better-looking woman. She walked with a wicked grace, like a panther with a pool cue. "What are you doing, Trouble?" She always called me Trouble,
even though I'm sure she had caused more than I ever would. Well, if it isn't what makes the Badlands look good. She wrote poetry and had been offered a scholarship to Dartmouth, but had decided to pursue billiards instead. She probably made more money at pool, but I wondered if she ever regretted not going to college. What are you up to other than luring men to their financial doom a quarter at a time? She rested her arms on the scaly sill of the truck, fingers drumming lightly on her exposed elbows.
I like torturing them slowly. Anyway, a girl's got to make a living, and I can't do it on what this guy pays me.
She pulled her lips back into a broad smile just to show me there was no malice.
There's a pool tournament down in Vegas, and I'm leaving next week.
I looked at the white fringe on the silk yoke of the Western shirt dress she wore. She always had on flamboyant Western clothes when she competed in the tournaments. Somehow, it didn't seem fair. She looked back toward the bar.
What's he doing in there?
Getting some wine for me.
Wine? For you?
What, I don't look like a wine guy to you? She reached in and felt the feathers on the rifle with her fingertips.
Ow!
She looked closer and her hand froze.
Oh, yeah.
That mean now?
No.
She shook her head.
No, it means terrible. Sahan.
Her eyes narrowed, and her hand came away from the gun as though the rifle might bite.
This is a weapon from the camp of the dead.
Actually, it's from Lonnie Littlebird. Her hands went to her hair, and I could tell she was unbraiding it for a reason. It's for a ballistics test. Her eyes met mine, and she continued to undo her long braid.
This is a ghost weapon. A weapon sent from the dead to retrieve.
Retrieve what?
Not what. Who?
What, they need a fourth for bridge? Her eyes sharpened to slits of flint.
This is not funny. It's big medicine.
Big medicine. I started to make another smart-aleck remark, but thought better of it.
I was just... Lonnie Littlebird gave this to you?
For ballistics. We've got to check it against the one that killed Cody Pritchard.
She finished unbraiding and shook her head, the dark hair falling loose over her shoulders. Give it back to him.
I will after we shoot it. I reached out to touch her arm, but she shifted away. What's the story with the hair?
It's a sign of respect and protection. There are spirits that linger near that weapon, and they can easily take away the soul of someone still living for the enjoyment of their society.
The hand that held the rifle suddenly felt cold, so I shifted to the other one. I'll get it right back to him just as soon as we get a test fire.
Henry had exited the bar with the two bottles of wine and opened the door of the truck, his eyes meeting Dina's.
What is up, Toots?
He climbed in, but her eyes stayed on him as he concerned himself with the shifter and with shutting the door. Finally, he cocked his head and looked at her again.
What?
You let Lonnie give him this?
His voice growled, low and steady. It is his job.
A full 15 seconds passed before she exhaled, turned, and walked into the Red Pony without looking back. The fringe on her dress matched the sway of her hair. I turned to look at him.
Women.
He put the truck in gear and backed away from the bar, hitting the tired brakes, shifting into first, and pulling out toward my place. I continued to look at him.
What?
What? I've got the Cheyenne death rifle here? He shook his head.
So to speak.
He glanced over.
Bother you?
Only if ghosts are going to fly out of the barrel and carry me off to the camp of the dead. He laughed a hearty, honest laugh.
What? He laughed some more. Your company is not that good.
The rifle, Henry, the ghosts, and me drove up the road and deposited me at my cabin. The rifle and I went in. Henry went back down the road, and where the ghosts went was anybody's guess. I carefully sat the rifle on the arms of my easy chair and looked at it. Retriever of the dead.
The thing was worth $1 million, was priceless, probably. And leaving it lying around my little house that had no locks didn't seem like a good idea. I was going to have to take it with me over to Vonnie's. But I could always leave it in a bullet. I wrestled a shower out of the bathroom and put on clean clothes. The phone machine in my bedroom was blinking, but I ignored it. The rifle was still there when I got back to the living room, so I looked around the place for any apparitions, and was a little disappointed when none appeared. Maybe Henry was right. Maybe I was lousy company, even at a dead man's party. I walked back into my bedroom and stared at the answering machine. I hoped that Katie had called, but the little blinking red light was looking angry. Maybe the ghosts had left a message. So I pushed the button.
Okay, we had 3 mailboxes at Rock Creek reportedly hit. Got a call on some kid chasing horses with his snow machine. Turns out the kid owned the horses, and there's no law saying you can't herd livestock with a snow machine. That from the 11-year-old perpetrator. Earl Walters slid off the road at Klondike and Upper Clear Creek and took out a yield sign. I always knew the ancient fucker couldn't read. And our crime of the day, old Lady Grossman reported somebody stealing the snowman out of her yard and driving off with it. Ferg stopped the suspect, who turned out to be her nephew, who had taken it as a joke.
We weren't likely to make America's most wanted with a selection of crimes such as these, but it was premium Roundup material.
So out of our list, the only ones that have reloading equipment are Mike Rubin and Stanley Fogel.
The dentist.
The dentist.
There was a pause as the machine recorded her thinking.
Wouldn't it be a pisser if it turned out to be the dentist? I know it doesn't have the ring that the butler does, but wouldn't people be surprised?
I nodded my head in agreement.
Anyway, I went over and checked on him. He's cute. I think I'm going to change dentists.
Jesus. There was a rustling of papers, and she continued.
I also went out to Mike Rubin's shop while you were out joyriding on the res. Is that fucker goofy or what?
I nodded.
I don't know if he was more rattled by having a sheriff's deputy there or a woman. He doesn't get out much, does he?
I shook my head this time.
I got samples from both, and neither match up with what we think we've got. The Ferg finally got around to checking on the Esper place, and he says that there weren't any tracks in the snow leading up to the house. I called the post office, and sure enough, they put a hold on their mail that goes off tomorrow. I called the mine and asked them. They said he was down in Colorado visiting his sister, no number left. The sister is married, and nobody here seems to know the name or where in Colorado they live, so here we are at the beginning. I'll swing around there tonight and see if they've gotten back from the other square state.
There was a pause, then the machine beeped, and she spoke again.
Okay, so I swung by the Espers and left a note behind the storm door telling them to contact us as soon as they get in. Ferg's right. There hasn't been anybody there for days. If they call, I'll call you. I'll be here tonight if you need me. All night. Glenn and I are fighting, so I'm sleeping here.
I stared at the machine.
Don't worry, it's nothing big, just the usual shit. Don't call to check on me, and don't come in here. I'm fine. Oh, and by the way, Phil Levant died about 3 months ago, so should I take him off our short list?
I nodded, and the machine clicked off. I hated marital discord. I hated it when I was married. I often wondered about Vic's marriage. There were times when she and Glenn appeared to get along, but most of the time it seemed like they led separate but unequal lives. This wasn't the first night she'd spent at the jail. She wasn't the frequent lodger I was, but only a month ago I'd been in my office one night catching up on paperwork when I heard somebody open the front door. As she walked into her office, opposite mine, all she said was, "Don't ask," and slammed her door behind her. After a few moments, though, she reappeared with her Philadelphia police mug and a bottle of tequila. Had sat down in the chair by my door, threw her feet up on my desk, poured herself a drink, and hissed, "All men are assholes, right?" I nodded vigorously, quietly finished my reports as she drank, and then crept out, my back to the wall. I fought the urge to call her and went back to the front of the house to collect the 2 bottles of wine and the rifle. It weighed enough to be haunted. The emotional toll of the day was having an effect on me, and I wondered if I wasn't already in the camp of the dead. I wondered if I hadn't been for the last 4 years.
I sat the bottle down and pulled the old girl from the scabbard, looking at the rubbed spots. The barrel was round, the heavy military model rather than the expected octagonal like Omar's. I looked at the beads attached to the hide covering on the foregrip. Dead Man's body was an intricate design of triangles, points, and geometric figures showing not only the body itself, but the wounds and the spears that had done the deed. Henry had explained that it was more of a Sioux pattern, but that might have been the reason for using it, to warn the Lakota that they should not take their alliance with the Cheyenne lightly. They were the small Venetian seed beads that had become more predominant around 1840 and had a richer color than the earlier pony style. The stitching was overlay, not the usual lazy stitch you saw nowadays, and when you held the rifle up to the light, there was no space between the rows. I thought about all those little strings of beads sailing across the Atlantic from Italy. Maybe Vic's ancestors had supplied the ornamentation for Henry's in 6 degrees of beaded separation. I smiled and made a conscious effort to be better company for the old Cheyenne, and to prove it, I raised the rifle high over my head and gave out with the most blood-curdling war cry I could manage. I'm pretty sure I could do it better when I was 7, but the shout rattled around my little house and made me feel better. So I did it 4 or 5 more times. The last one hurt, but was the best. I felt like an extra in a 50s B-movie, so I put the rifle back in its scabbard, picked up my wine, and headed for the truck. The temperature was dropping, and it was starting to look like we might get more snow. I hit the NOAA ban on my radio and listened to the little computer-generated Norwegian tell me that 2 to 4 inches was expected on the mountain, but only an inch down here. So far, not a flake had fallen, but I figured I could always call Henry. He could tell me exactly when it was going to begin. I started digesting Vic's oral report. The Espers worried me. If Reggie Esper and his wife had taken off for Colorado, and I believe his sister lived in Longmont, had the 2 boys gone with him? It didn't seem likely the 2 college-aged boys would go with their parents to visit an aunt for a week. I had honestly believed that Cody's death had been an accident, at least mostly, until the feather. I was getting that fretful, nagging feeling that this case might end with all the loose strands that I had picked free. The old police adage says, when you're done and there's nothing there, go back to the beginning and start over. So here I was, staring at the beginning and trying to figure out what it was I'd missed the first time. I turned into Vonnie's drive, pulled through the opening gate, and parked in front of the house. All the motion-detecting lights came on again, and I gathered up the stuff and started for the house. By the time I got to the porch, she had the door open.
You still look tired.
That bad, huh? The light from the entryway was warm and tawny, reflecting the reddish highlights of her hair as she stood in the doorway.
Your voice is hoarse. Are you all right?
Yep. I just had to do some shouting today. Sorry.
She took my arm as I got there. No, I like it. It's sexy.
I was feeling better, and gave her the 2 bottles of wine after she shut the door. Here, I brought wine. I picked it out myself. She looked at me for a moment, then her eyes dropped to the scabbard.
What's that?
I raised the rifle and shrugged. This is a very long story.
Is it a gun?
Yep.
Not in my house.
I looked at her face for the contention I expected to find, but there wasn't any. It was a simple statement of fact, and her eyes still held the warmth that had invited me in. I felt the need to explain. It's an expensive piece. It doesn't belong to me. And I thought it would be safer in here. She looked down at the rifle again, but didn't say anything. I'll put it back in the truck. I started to turn, but she caught my arm.
No.
There was a moment as she tried to weigh the options open to both of us. It's okay. I'll just lock it up in the truck.
No, I'm sorry.
Her face came up, and the smile was a little sad but generous.
Is it okay here, by the door?
I smile, too. Yep, that'll be fine. I propped the rifle in the corner and, for the first time, noticed my sheepskin coat draped across the chair that was also there. I turned and looked at her. You going to send me packing? She cocked her head and was instantly delicious.
No, I like the way it smells. And if you don't take it with you tonight, you're not likely to get it back.
With this, she turned and started down the hallway and through the living room where I had left her the last time I was here. She was wearing low-heeled ropers, buckskin leather-laced pants, and an off-white silk blouse with Western accents. The effect from the rear was breathtaking. I left the Cheyenne rifle of the dead to commune with the smell of my coat and pursued some preferred company myself. The elevated area between the arches was a dining room, and on the other side of it was the kitchen. The smell of something wonderful was drifting through the doorway, a delicate smell, tangy, but with an underlying sea scent that spoke softly to the base of my stomach. The olive loaf sandwiches had worn thin. The kitchen was a study in contrasts. The floors were Mexican tile, and the walls were the same reworked plaster as in the other parts of the house, only these were differing shades of red. Massive, hand-hewn beams straddled the room overhead, and the cabinets looked like they had been salvaged from somebody's lion shack. The actual appliances were huge, stainless steel brutes that reminded me of the DCI coroner's lab in Cheyenne. A number of things seemed to be simmering on the 8-burner stove, but my attention was drawn to the center island, where a small glass vase of tulips sat between festively painted plates and silverware that looked stately enough to have been used at the Queen's coronation. There were linen napkins and brass and silver rings, and I was getting the diminishing feeling that I was there to read the meter. I hope you don't mind if we eat in the kitchen. She went to the stove, lifted the lid on something, and stirred it with a long wooden spoon that came from a crock full of implements that was tucked into the corner of the counter. The steam rose and separated as it drifted past the shining, edged surface of the beams. I was willing to bet she didn't have to worry about mouse poop. She had turned and was looking at me. It just seemed cozier. If we eat in the dining room with just the two of us, it'll be like that scene from Citizen Kane. I nodded, trying to think of the scene from Citizen Kane, only able to come up with the one with the screaming cockatoo. In anticipation of the snow, I've made hot buttered rum. Or would you rather we start with some of this wonderful wine you've brought? I think it's only supposed to snow an inch. Henry had his magic. I had the little computerized Norwegian. But the hot buttered rum sounds great. She sprinkled sugar, cloves, and nutmeg into two thick faceted glass tumblers, poured rum on top, added a couple of sticks of cinnamon and hot water, and finished it off with a large dollop of what read on the wrapper as Irish country butter.
We'll save the wine for later. This'll do your throat some good.
She leaned on the counter and raised her own glass.
Here's to our first official date.
We touched glasses, and I felt the warmth in my chest before I even took a sip. So he was clinically depressed?
Undiagnosed.
Dinner was everything my stomach had hoped it would be. Pasta with a cioppino of spinach, tomato, clams, and mussels, and homemade country bread with which we both sopped up the leftover sauce. She followed this up with a homemade apple pie topped with vanilla bean ice cream and continued with the hot buttered rum in spite of the wine. My mood was so warm and tranquil that I was beginning to fear that I might fall right off the little Italian stools and onto the floor. I remember coming out here with Dad when I was a kid. He shod your father's horses and I tagged along.
Yes, I was trying to remember if I was here.
Yep, you were.
She looked into her glass. Was I a little snot?
Yep, you were.
She laughed a soft laugh. One chance and I blew it, huh? It was summer and you were gone all the other times. Didn't you used to go somewhere?
Maine.
Maine. Doesn't seem fair. Summer is the payoff in Wyoming. She stirred her drink with one of the thin sticks of cinnamon.
I didn't get much of a choice at the time.
I tried to steer the conversation without appearing boorish. Richest man in three counties. What did he have to be depressed about? She smiled, allowing the tiny bit of boorishness to pass.
I don't think he cared for himself too much.
How about you?
Did I care for him?
She paused, genuinely considering the question.
I suppose not. But the further down the road I go, the more I see my relationship with him having had an effect on every single choice in my life. In a negative or positive way.
She stared at the candles that had melted into the holders and blew them out.
That would have made him happy.
She stretched a hand across the table, and I stuck a paw out to meet her. She took my hand and turned it over, examining the creases on the sides of my fingers. I could feel an electric charge racing up my forearms as she traced the folds with a fingernail.
I like your hands. Big and powerful. But they move very carefully like an artist.
Piano lessons.
Really?
Very early on, I developed a love for boogie-woogie.
Oh, my. I guess that's what they call full-octave hands.
A moment went by.
That explains the piano at your house. You'll have to play for me.
I'm kinda out of practice, which is kind of the theme for my life as of late. There was a long pause.
One of the cowboys found him in the tack shed. I guess he didn't want to make a mess in the house.
She continued looking at my hand, and for a moment I thought she was going to cry, but instead she laughed, a short laugh, and smiled as she looked up at me.
Daddy's little girl. Not exactly the most compelling of psychological profiles, huh?
How could he leave something like you? It was out before I could analyze how corny it was going to sound. But she didn't laugh. Instead, it was a short, broken sob that forced her to wipe her nose and run the side of her thumb past the corner of her eye in an attempt to keep her mascara from running. I handed her my napkin, but held on to the other hand. She laughed this time and straightened slightly. "Where's your dog?" She sniffed and then laughed again.
"He's in the mudroom out back, sulking."
"Maybe I should meet him?" She straightened and imagined a run at the corner of her eye with the napkin.
"I didn't think you liked dogs."
"I like dogs fine. Does he like people?" She wiped her nose.
"He hasn't met that many."
"Great. Let me go get the rifle." This time the laugh was wholehearted. "Your father is why you don't allow guns in the house?"
"I just don't like them. It seems to me that no matter what, they always lead to bad things. My opinion is that, produced for their specific purpose, they are inherently bad."
We stared at each other for a moment, then she continued.
"I know that they are a necessary evil in your line of work, but I don't allow necessary evils in my home."
I cleared my throat and nodded. "How about your life?" Her eyes stayed with mine.
"I'll have to think about that."
"Okay." I released her hand.
"Speaking of necessary evils, where's the mudroom?"
She stood and patted the table the same way Brandon White Buffalo had earlier in the day.
"Maybe I better introduce the two of you."
I waited with my hot buttered rum and killed off the last bit of crust. For pies like this, a man could hang up the old star and gun and slowly become as large as a minivan in stretch jeans. I sat the fork down and listened to the clatter as very large claws attempted to gain purchase on the Mexican tiles. I heard mild protests and a few thumps, and I would have been alarmed but for the continued giggling that accompanied the general commotion. He was bigger than I remembered, and I remembered him being very big. He was caught by surprise at seeing somebody besides her in the house, and the disconcerted quality was evident in the head that was as big as a 5-gallon gas can and quizzically turned to the side. She still had a hold on the leather collar. If she hadn't, I'm sure he would have gone straight for me. I heard the throaty warning start deep in his chest as I desperately tried to remember the word for stew and hoped he understood Lakota. She slapped him on the head and growled herself.
"Stop that! Now!"
The change was instantaneous. The eyebrows shifted, and his head dropped. He looked like a scolded Kodiak. He began panting and looked at me with his head rising to a comfortable interest, ears forward and with the inquisitive slant once again visible. She shook his head a little with the collar but didn't release it. "There, you can come over and say hi." I stood, and his eyes traveled up with me, but he still seemed calm. I thought about what Henry had said about dogs and hoped this one wasn't Cheyenne. As I came around the center island, his tail began to wag. I knew the drill and approached, standing with my hand out, palm down, and fingers in. His big head stretched forward, sniffing. Then a tongue, as wide as my hand, lapped my knuckles. I stroked the big furry head and scratched behind his ears as a hind paw as big as my foot thumped on the ceramic surface. He's a big baby. We took our drinks into the living room, and she brought the phone from the kitchen. She said she was expecting a